haired weirdos, short haired weirdos, vandals, hooligans.
The government, hug the government, love the government, hug the government, love the government.
Welcome to The Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Michael Baranowski, a professor of political science at Northern Kentucky University. I'm joined today by my conservative counterpart, Cleveland area attorney and defender of freedom, Jay Carson.
Hey, good morning, Mike.
Hey, Jay, how are you doing this morning?
Well, Mike, I'm flying in the weekend with all the confidence of a private Russian pilot.
I'm having a pretty good day so far. I should point out to folks, if they didn't already know, today is, we're recording this Saturday, August 26th. It is National Dog Day, and I'm always happy to announce that. Of course, in our house, every day is Dog Day. We have three of them, but I think today I'll, you know, get spend some extra time with Olive and Gus and Bertram in honor of National Dog Day. And also,
well,
I wanted to
mention, it's National Dog Day now, they probably expect it.
You know, so. I think they probably would, and they have a right to, I think. But I also wanted to mention, I am currently reading a classic work that I have neglected to this point in my political education. It's somehow gotten past me. I don't know how, but I'm reading the Communist Manifesto, and it's interesting stuff. I got to say, once I got past the version I bought has, I kid you not, 191 pages of introduction, which is, yeah, I want to support the cause.
You're kind of missing the point, aren't you?
Marx maybe goes a little overboard on some things, but I think he largely nails it on the conditions of capitalism with, like I said, a little bit of maybe going overboard at times. In the end, I think, I realized, I'm more of a sort of a, I guess I'd describe myself as a Bakuninistic anarchist than a Marxist communist. So anarchism appeals to me.
That's
a little
good
bit more
to hear.
So, but I believe in smashing the state and the market, and it's picking up the pieces from there, I guess. I don't know. Anyway, maybe not. But
well, didn't you? I thought we were in the same political theory class, and that was required reading back then.
I might not have actually read that, Jay.
You might have skipped it.
I might have just, because you remember back then, of course, I was well to the right of you. And I could totally see myself protesting this by not reading it. And, that would have been, that would have definitely been a peak conservative Baranowski. But anyway. All right. So we have a lot we want to get at today. Certainly the Republican debate. We want to talk also about whether or not Donald Trump is even constitutionally eligible to run for president again. There's more on Donald Trump's indictments, the fires in Maui and some climate change stuff. As Jay alluded to, the death, murder, assassination of Yevgeny Prigozhin, the liberal bias of ChatGPT, some claim. Well, there's an awful lot there. We almost certainly won't get to all of it in the regular show, but we will get to all of it in the regular show and the midweek episode. And we'll get going on that right now. But before I do, very quickly, I want to thank our newest supporters, Matthew, Max, who's our first yearly supporter. That's a new thing we have. You can, support us yearly and save 10%. So there you go. So thank you guys so much. We really do appreciate your support. And all right. So let's jump right into it. Last Wednesday night, eight Republican presidential hopefuls. Well, actually, I guess I would say six presidential hopefuls, along with Asa Hutchinson and Doug Burgum, took the stage in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, for a soundbite competition that we'll call the debate, just for ease of our, I guess, conversation going forward. And Jay, it's your party. You can have it. So I'll just leave it at that. But let me just start with you. What were your impressions of this hour and 40-something minutes of debate adjacent like content?
Yeah, so I think you're right. I mean, anytime when you've got eight people on the stage, it's tough to call it a debate. It is more sort of a meet the candidates night. So I think that's the format just makes it difficult, right? And because you have so many people and so little time, there is the necessity to try to generate the one memorable soundbite quip that you're going to get that recognition. Overall, though, I think it was more substantive than what I expected. There was less Trump than I expected. Right. I sort of thought about originally sort of every question or every response would have been framed in terms of the guy who wasn't there. And there was some of that, to be sure, and necessarily so. But I don't think it dominated. There was some actual policy discussion or at least policy sound bites. I would say generally I feel like Mike Pence and Nikki Haley presented themselves as sort of the adults in the room. Whether that's going to be a selling point or not, I don't know. But I think Pence did himself a service, and I think probably the country a service, in asking others to indicate their support for his actions on January 6th. I was less impressed by Vivek Ramaswamy, who again I think comes across as very smart, well spoken, but in this case, I think some of the sniping came across as kind of juvenile. Now maybe that's picking on him because he's 38, which is weird at a time in my life now where I look at 38-year-olds as these kids. Right. I mean, usually when I was 38, geez, old man. But I think he has a lot to offer the party in the future. I don't see him having the, I'll bring up the word gravitas, I guess, that I might have hoped for. And especially on foreign policy stuff. That Trumpman, where I think Pence and Nikki Haley, brought sort of more seriousness. Tim Scott, who I generally like as a candidate, and sort of fits in that Kempian hope, growth, and opportunity lane. My sense was he sort of underperformed. He didn't. I was sort of hoping for a breakout performance from Tim Scott, and I didn't see it. I don't think he did poorly, right? But it wasn't no one walked away from the from Wednesday night saying, "Wow, Tim Scott."
Well, yeah, and part of that is the only two candidates who had less speaking time were Burgum and Hutchinson. So you just didn't hear much from Tim Scott.
So then when you come to DeSantis, and to some extent, I would say, in a debate without Trump there, it's sort of DeSantis is to lose, and I think he did. I wasn't overwhelmed, and I think the sort of the sheepish hand raise thing, seeing what everybody else did first. Again, it's one of those dumb trivial things, but in this kind of optics debate sort of bit, it can those things can make a difference.
No, right? I think that's telling it. And for people who didn't see that moment, that's when the question was asked of all the candidates: if Donald Trump is convicted in a court of law, will you support him as your party's nominee? Now, the one hand that went up, like almost like it was on like spring assisted, was Ramaswamy, who clearly is running for VP, I think, at this point. But and then you kind of had the domino effect of Haley, Scott, and Burgum, who thought, I don't know, what the hell at this point. But yeah, you notice DeSantis looking both ways and then popping his hand up there. And it was, I thought you're right. That was so telling of Ron DeSantis.
Look, in fairness, right? I mean, I think you want to sort of have the situational awareness to see, hey, what is everyone else doing? I'm just, curious to see where everyone else is. That said, you should also, if you're running for president, I would think you would have rehearsed and expected this question. And you would have an immediate either hand up or hand down, and shaking your head. And then you can look around.
Yeah. Well, on that, I think that aside from DeSantis, the two most interesting responses were, well, number one, for Hutchinson, who was the only one who didn't do anything with his hand, just kept his hand at his side. Not that he really matters, obviously. But The Chris Christie response was interesting. That kind of half-hearted rage that sort of turned into a wag, that turned into a head shake. And I got to say, you know, there's a part of me that really is drawn to the sort of pugnaciousness of, there's something about Chris Christie's approach.
Yeah, I didn't mention Christie.
He got, and
to some extent, see if you agree with me on this. Christie can kind of get away with that, whereas DeSantis, it seems harder to get away with.
Well, I think it's part of Christie's DNA. You know, it's what you expect of a Christie.
It's a New Jersey kind of thing.
Exactly.
You know? It's like, eh.
But the whole, all of the, I think it was very telling, all of the boos that Chris Christie got. And I admire the fact that, you know, I thought he played that very well, saying, hey, that's, you know, that's the great thing. You know, you can.
You're implying a negative reaction from the audience, not that he was drinking.
Saying that.
I just sort of that sentence, the thing that surprised me about Christie was all the boos.
Oh, yeah, yeah, right. No, but when he said, you know, booing's allowed, but it doesn't change the truth. And he's right. I think I strongly agree with him that Donald Trump has absolutely disgraced the office of the presidency, and he's unfit to be president. And of course, the audience clearly disagreed with that. And I give Chris Christie a certain amount of credit. I think he knows that he's, you know, go ahead.
Yeah, and I was going to say, and Christie's done that in other forums as well. I think CPAC and some others, where he's been vocally critical of Trump's character, gotten the boos, and sort of waved it off. And yeah, boo all you want. So,
do you think that was a fair question about if Donald Trump is convicted? I mean, let's say you're asked that question. You're a likely Republican primary voter.
So it in some ways it's not a fair question, right? Because I think the better question is convicted of what and by whom, right? For example, if Trump is convicted by Alvin Bragg on the it's somehow campaign finance violation or something to pay hush money to porn stars. Then no, I think that's absolutely, you know, that to me, that would seem to be, well, that's not a real crime. It's not a real felony. This was prosecuted for overreach. If on the other hand, he's indicted for a felony of misusing confidential information and obstruction of justice to cover that up, I think that's a different story. So I think the question is a little unfair, I think if you're a presidential candidate, instead of doing the raise of hands thing, I think you can, you know, say it depends on, you know, are we talking about a real crime or not? And I've you know, you and I can go through this, and I've sort of ranked them before of the hierarchy of Trump indictments. Which I think are, you know, real crimes, which I think are, you know, areas of concern and maybe indictable, depending on what evidence we see, and ones that I think are entirely ludicrous. But, you know, so I think there is that.
Well,
but
in some way, I think it was.
I think now there's also the other argument that, well, no, I don't, you know, you can just make the political calculation and say, look, if the guy's an indicted felon, he's not going to be a great candidate. But
in a way, I feel, well, I think the more interesting question, probably not in some ways, would have been, do you feel Donald Trump is fit to be president of the United States? And
And that one, I think that is a more fair question.
And so I think on that, based on what we saw, you would have gotten a no from Christie, and I don't know if Hutchinson actually has the power of speech, but assuming he did, he would probably have said no on that. But the rest of them, untroubled by that, and I think that's just political calculation, essentially for a lot of them. But you know, you're on the indictments, multiple Trump indictments thing. That reminded me, I wanted to correct a misperception, that sort of a persistent misperception. Listeners who tuned in last week, is it tuned in? I don't know if you tuned into a podcast, checked out the podcast last week, know that Trey and Ken were talking about the Trump indictments. And one thing that Trey had said, and he said it before, I believe, is that Jay and I have argued that the various prosecutors should have in some way colluded, gotten together to release their indictments for maximum political effect. And after I heard this I heard it the second time, and I was listening to the show when I was installing a ceiling fan. I practically fell off of the ladder. It's like, no, we didn't say that. And just to correct the record, no, neither Jay or I has ever said that. What we said, and Jay, you'll correct me if I'm wrong, is that we believe that the Bragg indictment was prosecutorial overreach, was essentially almost a made up or certainly legal stretch of a felony. Now, we certainly, I certainly discussed how it would probably have more political impact if the first indictment to come out had been something that I felt was much more substantive.
Smith one, for
like,
example.
Yeah, like the Smith ones. But I never would have suggested, never would have deemed it. I agree with Ken. It would be completely unethical for the prosecutors to do that. You indict when you're able to indict, and that's how it should be. And so I just wanted to clear that up. And Jay, I'm pretty sure you feel the same way about that.
I do feel the same way, yes.
Okay, but back to the debates. There were, I think you're right, there was some substance aside from the Trump question. The one other question that came up, right, the national abortion ban, I thought that was interesting given the candidate responses about that, would you support a national abortion ban? And I think Ron DeSantis, there's this 6-week ban in Florida. I believe that's held up in the courts. But he said, I understand Wisconsin will do it different than Texas. Iowa and New Hampshire will do it different, but I'll support the cause of life as a governor and as a president. And Burgum, if anyone was listening to him, said something I think sort of similar. The feds are stepping into people's lives and stepping into people's businesses over and over. If we say the feds should be in this, where do we stop? And Jay, to me, that seemed like sort of the old-fashioned, traditional.
We believe, I think those are both good answers. Yeah.
Yeah. But everyone else is like, oh yeah, let's use the power of the state to impose this national regime. And I thought, my gosh, traditional.
Well, I don't think Nikki Haley was there. I think she was.
Well, yeah. Yes. No, I disagree. I liked her answer in a way, because what she said is that we don't have the votes to do this. And don't lie to people and tell them that you're going to do this when we don't have the votes. But it's just very different from saying, I disagree with this because I believe federalism is an important thing, even if it cuts against us. And I wanted to get your take on that issue.
No, I would go with the if you're asking me, like, how would I answer, what do I think would be the doctrinaire old school conservative response, is that federalism is what we're all about, laboratories of democracy. This is part of why, Roe versus Wade was such a problem, because it was a non-legislative, non-elected body imposing a national policy, and that was the issue for three reasons: one, unelected; two, national; and three, it's a policy that our side doesn't like. So I think at least you can say. Hey, let's move into that second area where states should be able to determine if this is a state issue, which constitutionally we now have determined that it is. I believe that we ought to trust the states and the voters of those states to do what they see best for their state. Some of them may come up with terrible ideas and terrible bills, but I think, these things work themselves out over time. So that's, I would have taken that old school federalist approach, if you will. And you can still say, I am all for life, and I would argue and fight at the state level for the restrictions I feel to be appropriate. But saying the federal government ought to get into everyone's business, I think is problematic on a whole lot of fronts.
But I think that's a losing argument for a lot of people. I mean, Doug Burgum can say what he wants because it's not like he's going anywhere. And certainly Nikki Haley was right in terms of vote counting and strategy. It's rare for me to say I find myself in agreement with Ron DeSantis on this. But I certainly do. But I think it's indicative of the direction in which the Republican Party has gone. Now, Democrats have always believed in national solutions to problems, or at least certainly more than right. Republicans. But the modern Republican Party is much more comfortable imposing its regime on the country as a whole than the Republican Party of your and my youth was.
Right. And that troubles me. I mean, I'm not running for anything. I'm a guy who, you know, rolls out of bed and does a Saturday morning podcast. But to me, the more that candidates out there, especially, and maybe this is candidates to the guys lower on the ticket, can go and make the principled philosophical arguments of this is what we believe in. It's not even so much the policy, it's that where the policy should come from. The better we are overall articulating a message.
Principled, let's say that again. Principled philosophical arguments.
What world are you living in?
I don't know, but I hear what you're saying, and I think it's certainly nice to hear them a little bit. Though, of course, when you have 1 minute to respond or 1 minute to reply and 30 seconds for a response,
I mean that's extremely tough.
Yes, yeah. Good luck making a principled philosophical argument. I also want to talk about Ukraine because there's a pretty big difference here. Right. I mean, you mentioned Ramaswamy, your concerns about his foreign policy stance. I mean, he said we're protecting against an invasion across someone else's border and we should use those same military resources to prevent the invasion of our own southern border here in the United States of America. And just to be clear,
I think that's a false comparison.
Yeah. And Mike Pence pointed that out, I think. But I'm disturbed not just by that, but also by the fact that he clearly meant use military force because he said that at least twice during the debate. And the idea that we would employ the same sort of military resources to, I don't know what, to bomb people coming over the border.
Build a wall and bomb Mexico.
I mean, this is, if that's not a dog whistle, I don't know. It's a pretty audible one, actually. So it's just a whistle, I guess. But I find everything about Ramaswamy just repugnant, actually. Just there's not a thing I like about that guy. I think he's awful.
Oh, so I wouldn't mind a Ramaswamy as a Secretary of Commerce or something like that. But, And look, I think there's a legitimate case to be made in terms of do we need some sort of military intervention in terms of human trafficking, in terms of the fentanyl smuggling, in terms of Mexican drug cartels.
But you're aware we can't use the military on U.S. I mean, you're aware of the legal prohibitions against that. So, I mean,
cooperation with the Mexican government, of course.
So you're suggesting that maybe part of a solution is to have Mexico agree to have U.S. military forces conducting some sort of military operations on Mexican soil?
I'm saying that's not outside. I don't think that should be outside the Overton window.
If you're going to put it that way, sure.
That's what I'm saying. Okay. I think the case can be made that, listen, whatever is happening down in Mexico because of either the inability or the lack of political will to deal with some of these problems, at some point it becomes incumbent upon us to do something about it. So
are you concerned when candidates like Ramaswamy and other prominent voices call what we're seeing an invasion?
Not necessarily. I mean, I suppose it's, you know, you're talking figuratively versus literally. I mean, is it an armed invasion? Well, in some cases, yes. I mean, we've got video of traffickers coming across the border heavily armed. Now their purpose is not to invade and overthrow the country. Their purpose is just to move people and move drugs. But
I find the term deeply offensive.
When you've got the volume of people crossing the border illegally, I think invasion is an apt metaphor. Let's put it that way.
Oh, I think it's a horrible metaphor because of the reason that you said. These are not people who are trying to invade in any real sensitive. It reduces human beings to either some sort of barbarian horde who are trying to destroy us, or instincts, or insects. It's dehumanizing. It's disgusting. And again, it's just one of the many reasons why I find Ramaswamy a repellent figure.
What words would you use for millions of people coming across a border that illegally?
How about humanitarian crisis?
All right, that works.
I don't hear a whole lot of that in Republican debates.
The next question, though, is, we could dig deeper into that.
Maybe immigration. I hear you. We were not either of us prepared for a discussion of immigration and human trafficking and all that. And so we can put that to the side. That's fair. But you know, any other before, because we've been spending a lot of time on this. One thing I did want to get to, though, was the elephant that wasn't in the room, right? Donald Trump, who decided to skip the debate and do that interview on X with Tucker Carlson. Any thoughts on that, either the strategic decision or the content of the interview itself?
So the strategic decision, this is something that's always troubled me, having worked in politics and politics adjacent, right? There is a sense, of honor, if you will, right? That you feel like people ought to debate, people ought to get out there and mix it up. If you're running, you shouldn't be afraid to go out and stand on the stage and say your thing. On the other hand, if I am a campaign manager or strategist, and I've got a candidate who is far in the lead, it would be sort of professional malpractice to recommend that. And I guess there's always this tension there, right? Because I see the one side being, I think it's the more honorable course to go out there and stand up and debate and so forth. But if you're asking me from a purely Machiavellian political strategy standpoint, then no, the better thing is to not go. And I think that can get played out at some point, right? If you're never showing up, then there's a problem. But if you're declining to debate a person who's got a significant poll following, right? Then I think it smacks of cowardice. But if it's the, you know, if Trump is sort of looking at this, and quite honestly, look, so are we, right? We're looking at the debate is who's the candidate who's really going to run against Trump, as opposed to who's the Republican nominee going to be, right? There's sort of like two stages in the Republican primary contest this year. It's going to be who is going to challenge Trump, and then who will be the actual nominee.
I understand
why he's doing it, and also in light of his recent troubles, you would have a bunch of, perhaps responses of under advice of counsel, I'm declining to answer that question, sort of responses that just aren't going to play well. So better to stay home and do a friendly sit down with Tucker.
You just said that. I cannot imagine. I can imagine a lot coming out of Donald Trump's mouth, but the phrase under advice of counsel, I decline to answer that question, it's almost incomprehensible for me to think of that. And I got to say, I agree with you strategically. It doesn't make sense. I also point out that to millions of Americans and possibly to Donald Trump himself, he is the incumbent president, and incumbent presidents do not debate as a general rule. And so I think there's that as well. Now, I think the actual thing he did with Tucker was pretty bland for the most part, sort of underwhelming. There were a couple of lines there. You know, the one thing he mentioned, Biden, he said, it looks like he's walking on toothpicks. And I was like, man, that is a great line. I mean, Trump can do that in a way that someone like a DeSantis just simply can't. But, you know, whenever I think about Trump and Carlson, I think of that Carlson private line right in his text. I hate him passionately. And I think, my God, here we have, I mean, I watched, you know, I'm watching and just thinking, here we have two of the finest grifters in modern American society getting together, kind of hanging out. And I just, oh, God, just
they appreciate one another. You know, they hate them, in a certain way. You know, again, it's they're both willing to put that aside for the sake of business.
Well, that's what a good grifter does. You know, hey, if you can work a long con with someone, you do that and then you kind of go your separate ways. But, yeah, I've also, whenever these debates come about, I think, would there even be a way to do this in a format that wouldn't be so awful? I mean, because it's not just the 1 minute to answer, 30 seconds to respond, but also the top polling candidates in the center, other folks at the side almost guaranteeing that they're just going to be afterthoughts, which in fact they were. And I've never come up with a good solution, but I thought about something a couple days ago. I'll run it by you. You're going to think it's dumb, and that's okay. But how about a tournament of one-on-one debates with polling-based seating? So you have
people would fill out brackets and stuff?
Yeah, like a DeSantis Burgum first round, Ramaswamy Hutchinson, and then you have them who gets to go to the next round is done by a poll of a random sample of likely Republican primary voters, and you build up to the final four and the last. I don't know. There would be much more exciting, and there'd be more time for some potential substance. I know it'll never happen, but it just kind of caught my fancy. That's a pretty bad idea, isn't it?
I don't know.
Well, thank you. I'll take that. I'd like to see something different, something that's not this excruciating hot mess that we saw in Milwaukee and that we're going to see next month. I think it is in where's the next debate? I don't know where it is. It's the end of September. Maybe I think there's supposed to be a third one sometime in October. Nikki Haley said something about that, I think, but I don't think the RNC has confirmed that. At least in the next one, we won't have Hutchinson and Burgum to kick around anymore, and maybe that will help to streamline things a little bit. But God, these things they're just painful to watch. I think.
You know what also might be interesting would do like team debates.
Team debates. Explain.
On certain, I don't know, maybe you couldn't do that because there's too much space between people. But no, I mean, now that you've got sort of a, you know, different wings of the party, if you will, although they're not always coalesced completely on the same issues. So, I mean, I'm like a weird person to ask about this because my tastes tend not to run to the popular tastes, right? It's sort of like it's almost like a George Costanza do the opposite kind of thing.
Well, there was that Oscar Wilde quote, whatever is popular.
I'm sort of like, yeah. that must be the wrong, unpopular thing to do. If I could screen movies or, you know, music or something like that and say, this is a hit here. And then they would know to, you know, dump it because it would have no popular appeal.
You are not the typical Republican primary voter, and I will say the party is much the worse because of that.
I've actually never heard that Richmond, North of Richmond song, nor the Don't Try This in a Small Town or whatever.
That's because you're a cultural elitist, Jay. I think we've established.
I am a cultural elitist. I go much more, and you know what, you know, back in the day, you know, this is sort of, you know, our little pitch line that I've used about when people are asking about our show. I say, well, it's kind of like firing line meets car talk. And older people know both of those. But obviously, William F. Buckley's firing line program, where it was, you would sit down with guests and you would often have sort of teams and debate for, you know, there was like an hour, sometimes hour and a half long show. Of you know, guys, mostly guys, you know, just sitting around, you know, talking
boring.
Back and forth.
And I mean, that's
exactly, yeah. It just doesn't, Now, again, one of those guys is William F. Buckley, who could be immensely funny and entertaining and so forth. Sometimes they actually did like debates, you know, sort of by the whole rules and, you know, resolved, you know, resolved communism sucks, kind of thing. And this used to be on public television. And I would have to think if William F. Buckley were alive today, they, you know, wouldn't let him, you know, within 500 yards of a public television studio. But that's sort of what I grew up with and what I missed to some extent. And I think that sort of the idea that debates are something highbrow and an intellectual exercise, sort of devolved, right, over time into what we see now. It's almost like it used to be sort of like if you were, saying, oh yes, I'm, you know, spending the evening watching the presidential debate. That was a kind of a, you know, virtue signaling of, well, I am a cultural elitist. I am a smart person who cares deeply about important public issues. Whereas now it's almost a little embarrassing. It's like, you know, admitting you're watching the Real Housewives or something.
And clearly, I mean, it's a popular format. I think Fox announced that it was the highest rated non-sports event on cable TV this year. So, I mean, it works for the ratings, and that's really what it's all about.
Yeah. Well, and look, to some extent, like I said, maybe if they relabeled it as Candidates Night or something like that, right? Meet the candidates, as opposed to a debate, it might be something different. When I had my brief foray into actual running for office, you would do these rounds of Candidates Nights for all these various groups. And it was sort of that of like everybody gets 2 minutes, essentially. You know, you get up and you introduce yourself and you say where you're from, and you get maybe, you know, that takes probably a good 30 to 45 seconds. And then you say your platform, which is, you're generally for hope, growth, and opportunity, or something like that. And then that's, thank you very much. and maybe, you know, that's, 'cause that's almost what we have in these.
Moving on, or really maybe not moving on, Jay, you know, you can make a case that Donald Trump shouldn't have been on that stage in Milwaukee, not just because it was a good strategy for him not to be, but because he's actually not eligible, constitutionally eligible, to run for president. And I know that may seem like some sort of far left fever dream, but it's actually a legal argument that's recently been made by two highly respected, I was going to say card-carrying Federalist Society legal scholars. Do you guys get cards? I don't know. So
we don't, Mike. Although we
there really should be should. Cards anyway. If there were, these guys
we
don't would
need
carry
cards.
Them.
We can sort of we can recognize one another by secret hand signals and so forth.
Anyway, these two guys, William Baud and Michael Stokes Paulson, they wrote a 126-page article that's forthcoming in the University of Pennsylvania Law Review called "The Sweep and Force of Section 3." And their argument, in very brief, it's, after all, it's 126 pages, is this. Section 3 of the 14th Amendment prohibits any former official who's broken their oath to support the Constitution by engaging in insurrection or rebellion against or giving aid and comfort to insurrectionists or rebels. So if you did that and you were an office holder, you broke your oath, you can't run for office again. You're constitutionally ineligible. Now, this was clearly intended to apply to former Confederate officials after the Civil War, but there's no language in it that limits its application to that particular case. And what the authors argue is that Section 3 also is not just not limited, still applies, but it's also self-executing, which means that it requires no action from Congress to go into effect, and that basically it's the duty of every federal or state official who judges qualifications, like secretaries of state who put people on the ballot or not, to apply that constitutional qualification. And so they argue basically that the events that led up to and culminated in January 6th qualify as an insurrection. They defined that as a concerted, forcible resistance to the authority of government to execute the laws in at least some significant respect, and that Donald Trump played a role in this insurrection, as well as gave aid and comfort to other insurrectionists on January 6th, both by his comments that urged them to fight, as well as by his hours of inaction when they in fact did storm the Capitol. And you know, these are not frivolous guys, Jay, and this is a serious, very thorough argument. And I did more than just read the commentaries on it. I pulled up the whole 126-page PDF and read through the argument in detail. And I got to say,
a lot of that's footnotes.
Yeah, but your article. That's true. But what's your reaction to it?
So look, I think as an academic exercise, it's worthwhile. It's interesting. I disagree with, and I would say, yeah, if someone sponsored an insurrection, aided and abetted, gave aid and comfort to an insurrection, then yes, Section 3 would apply. What I disagree with is the premise that Trump did those things. I think Trump did a lot of stupid things. But I don't think that what he did was an insurrection.
Okay, so let me break this down.
At least based on the facts as we understand them at this time.
Okay, let me see if I understand what you're saying, because I don't want to critique what you're saying unless I actually am critiquing the correct thing. So are you saying that you do not believe, obviously you said that you think that Section 3 of the 14th Amendment still is in effect, and that it doesn't necessarily just apply to the Civil War.
It's in the Constitution. It's in the Constitution.
Okay.
Yeah.
And do you also agree that it is self-executing? That's another important point.
Yeah, self-executing. I think the way this would work, and I don't know exactly how it would work in the real world, but I think the way it would work is that a Secretary of State or someone like that official could say, now I think they would need some sort of actual conviction, right?
I don't think so. But that's another. We'll talk about that in a minute.
But I would be leery of saying, a Secretary can say, of State could say, I think this guy was an insurrectionist, so I'm not going to qualify him. Now, it all sort of ends up in the same place, I think, because then the candidate sues and says, no, you lack the authority to do that. I think it's a different situation if, you know, there is a federal conviction to say, hey, this guy committed an insurrection or acts amounting thereto, right? Sedition or something like that against the government, and here's the piece of paper and the conviction, and I'm the Secretary of State, and I'm going to say that disqualifies. I think that's an easier case. The other way would obviously be a third party or an opposing candidate could bring some sort of like a mandamus action to have this person declared, or not really a mandamus action, declaratory judgment action. Maybe mandamus against the Secretary of State to require him to remove the candidate, or declaratory judgment. You would phrase it as both, to say that this person is ineligible because of X, Y, and Z. At which point it goes to courts and works its way through the system. So by self-executing, I would agree that I don't think you need an additional act of Congress to put it into effect.
Because in other parts of the Constitution, including other parts of the 14th Amendment, when there was additional congressional action required, it will say Congress has the authority to enact this through, or to apply this through appropriate legislation, that sort of language.
Right. Like, for example, the Voting Rights Act and so forth. Yeah.
And on that, I also want to point out the text of Section 3 does not say the person shall have been convicted of insurrection or giving aid and comfort.
I think you need to have some actual factual predicate.
Okay.
As opposed to just, hey, I think this guy did it. Now, again, in the context in which it was written, it was sort of, they're talking about people like Jefferson Davis, who was president of the Confederacy. It's pretty clear. Or even someone, what color uniform were you wearing, and which side were you shooting from?
So what if Congress passed some sort of a thing saying that there was this insurrection on January 6th. I mean, that would at least, and I should point out, I mentioned this because Congress did in fact issue public law 117-32 passed by unanimous consent in the Senate, a 406-21 vote in the House, signed into law by Joe Biden. So this is not like this was not a partisan lines kind of thing, obviously. And as part of that public law, it includes the following congressional finding, and I'll read the text. On January 6, 2021, a mob of insurrectionists forced its way into the U.S. Capitol building, so on and so on. So they specifically, you cannot have a mob of insurrectionists without an insurrection. It does not logically follow. Explain this.
I'm goofing with you a little bit. Okay. Right? But I think you can. Yeah.
But my point is you can make a reasonable argument that Congress even has said that, yes, there was an insurrection, because they talk about a mob of insurrectionists, and not just the Democrats in Congress, but pretty much everyone in Congress agreed to that. And so my point, I guess, is that I think a Secretary of State would be well within his or her rights by saying, no, Donald Trump's name cannot go on this ballot. I know he's filed a candidacy. And I'm not going to put his name on, because just like I wouldn't put the name on of somebody who's not of age or not born in the United States, he is not eligible. And then the Trump campaign would presumably sue. It's just like, I think a voter in any of those jurisdictions would be well within their rights to say, hey, Donald Trump is on the ballot and he shouldn't be, because he's constitutionally ineligible. And so I'll bring suit. And I think that's not a frivolous case.
I'm thinking through the standing question on that, about whether the voter can bring it, or whether it would, an opposing candidate, I'm pretty sure, would have standing to bring it.
Well, I think as a voter, you can argue that your interests are being affected because the fact that there is a candidate who is not qualified.
I get it. I think what I'm not sure where that goes. I'd have to think about that some more.
As Ken has pointed out, standing is a very flexible sort of document oftentimes. And if a court wants to find standing, it can. But I think in this case, I think there would be clear standing. But what about as a legal argument? You know, you said, well, this is fine as an academic sort of thing. But I would push back and say, well, this is the Constitution we're talking about, and it's more than just an academic thing. And certainly there are going to be lawsuits about this. There are groups that have plans in place. We should see this as early as late this year, when the first filing deadlines come in. I think Nevada is the first state and a few after that. So this is a thing that is going to happen. And maybe you can talk about it from that perspective as a real world practitioner of the law.
Yeah, let me hit on one thing you said earlier, though, first, and that is Congress has deemed this to be an insurrection, or has deemed that there were insurrectionists coming into the building. That I think is a problem, because under that theory, you would allow Congress to invalidate the candidacy of any candidate.
No, I'm sorry. Either I misspoke or you misunderstood. What I meant is that if, as part of a legal argument, someone bringing suit would to say, well, where is there any sort of a certification or ratification of
Congress,
you can say exactly, as opposed to just, this is more in response to your comment of, well, just because the Secretary of State decides that Donald Trump is an insurrectionist.
There needed to be a conviction or a factual predicate. Yeah.
Right. And so that was my response to that, saying that, well, here is almost everyone in Congress saying that there was, in fact, an insurrection. Now, there's that separate point then of, if there was, in fact, an insurrection, was Donald Trump either A, an insurrectionist himself, or B, someone who gave aid and comfort to the insurrectionist? Now, I think A is a stretch. I disagreed with the argument there, because I feel like his language was sort of standard political rhetoric, and he did in fact say be peaceful. I think that is a legal losing argument, but the fact that he stood by watching on TV and did nothing for hours once there was this invasion of the Capitol, then I think that's a much stronger argument for giving aid and comfort.
No, that's a stronger argument. I would agree with you on that. My point on using a congressional statement as evidence would be, could a Republican Congress say Joe Biden has engaged in an insurrection by knowingly taking unconstitutional acts like attempting to forgive student loans without congressional authority? We find this is in clear violation of the Constitution, as did the Supreme Court. This was nothing short of an insurrection against our form of government. Therefore, he should be ineligible.
Well, sure, but
that's what I'm saying.
But they can do that now. I mean,
a political branch to make that determination.
But I think that then that's just tossed out very quickly as being frivolous. Just like if someone wanted to argue, not that anyone would do this, Donald Trump, that Barack Obama was not born in the United States and therefore is not eligible to run for president. I mean, a court takes a look at this.
But the idea would be the Obama piece. There would be some factual determination at some point, right? Whereas if it is just, hey, these are a gang of insurrectionists, or they committed insurrection, and you're not the qualified, judge and jury, so to speak, you're just acting as Congress.
But I guess what I'm saying is that the courts deal with frivolous lawsuits all the time, right? And there was a mechanism for dealing with the God knows how many, but there are an awful lot of them. And so that's fine if Republicans want to say that Joe Biden is an insurrectionist. It's a ridiculous claim with nothing to support it, and they can't point to anything. And so,
I'm saying right now, I can point to a Supreme Court decision that says he abused his powers. He overstretched.
Sure, but that's not insurrection.
Insurrection.
You can make that claim. I'm not denying you the right to make that claim in front of a federal judge. You should be able to make that ridiculous claim and waste your time on it. But that's why I think we're
talking past each other. My issue is that if Congress can say it, right? If you have the votes, the claim isn't frivolous. If that's what I'm saying. If you're using a congressional finding as evidence.
I'm using it as a piece of evidence. I'm using it as part of a case that one might make, essentially. That also, and Donald Trump's very words, and the fact, I mean, there are documented facts here. We know that these people were in the Capitol for hours and Donald Trump did nothing. We know
yeah,
that. That
no,
is
no,
a,
I agree.
And so that's what I'm saying. I'm not saying that this should be the only piece of evidence as if, as opposed to something like a conviction, which I think would be much stronger. But I wonder then if you agree with me that this is not, if someone brings suit, which someone will do, that this should not be just dismissed as being frivolous.
No, I would say it would pass a motion to dismiss test.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. Whether it actually succeeds on the facts. And again, this is a question that don't know if anybody's taken a look at this. I could go back and, maybe there are some cases in the 1870s or something like that, where someone challenges someone to say, hey, he was a, Confederate general or something.
Well, there was that blanket amnesty too that Congress passed back then that sort of covered a lot of that. But
obviously, I mean, here's the thing. If those cases were decided on a congressional act, then they were decided wrongly.
No, I meant because part of Section 3 says that Congress can I forget how it is, but can forgive case or can remove the disability by a 2/3 vote, and so that's what happened there. But one thing we haven't talked about though, Jay, regarding this is the politics of it, and I would argue that I think that having read through the entire law review argument, I think that that is a good case. I think that I would maybe be persuaded to say Donald Trump is constitutionally ineligible for giving aid and comfort to insurrectionists. But I think from a political standpoint, I might actually put the law aside a little bit because it's a close thing, I think, for me. Because I think politically and for the country as a whole, that would be a disastrous way to rule. Because it would be seen as basically just disqualifying this man who half the country or nearly half the country, maybe 40% of the country, 30, 40% thinks incredibly highly of and feel is being completely shafted. And any sort of a judicial ruling that would say, no, he can't even run on less than absolutely rock solid grounds, that would be disastrous for the country. So even if I'm convinced, the general weight of things suggests that, yeah, I think maybe he shouldn't, I don't think I could rule that way as a judge simply because of what I know, what I feel it would do to the country. And maybe that's putting other factors ahead of strict fidelity to the law. But, you know, judges have done that time immemorial.
Well, I think there's a judicial interpretation argument to be made when you get into, okay, the text, how is the text interpreted, understood in its original context? In that context, it would have, insurrectionist would have meant someone who joined the Confederacy and made war upon the United States.
Yeah, though I would be, see, I couldn't do that.
I think that's not unreasonable. That's a not unreasonable reading.
See, that, but that's the sort of thing that I think in many cases conservatives have rightly critiqued liberals for doing, for saying that, well, here's a aspect of the Constitution I want to break my way, so I'm going to interpret it out so it breaks that way. And I think there's something to be said for, well, the words are what the words are. And if Congress wanted to say former members of the Confederacy, they could have said that, but they chose not to. Once we start playing word games with that and putting stuff into the Constitution that's not there, that's a road that I'm uncomfortable going down, even if it helps to benefit my side.
The Clarence Thomas-y kind of version of this would be, the first thing you look at is the text, obviously, right? But then the second piece is, okay, well, what did insurrection mean in 1868? I think, right? 1867. And then I think that's a fair view to take. Now, let's see, I'm trying to think of.
But you're not saying that 14th Amendment, Section 3, only applies to former members of the Confederacy.
No. Okay. No, I'm not saying that.
Okay.
But I am saying insurrection, as that term is used in the 14th Amendment, ought to be read in terms of how it was understood by the general public when the amendment was ratified, rather than anything that a contemporary Congress or Secretary of State might come up with.
But yeah, I agree. But I would also argue that a group of people storming the Capitol and chanting about hanging the vice president who is going to and Congress is going to certify the election for the person who did not win the election, if that's not an insurrection, I'm not really sure what is.
Well, let me. Because this is an interesting question for me. Say you're a political candidate and you go to speak to a group, pro Second Amendment group, and you're there and you say, "I love the Second Amendment. I love guns. Guns for everybody. My opponent will take your guns. I won't let him." Now, supposing in the audience are a number of militia members, who totally believe in, yeah, I think we should have guns. And in fact, we got to really just get rid of the federal government. Are you providing aid and comfort to insurrectionists?
That's a separate question. I see what you're saying. But the first question you have to determine.
Your opponent therefore say, hey, this guy gave a speech to these crazy militia guys who want to overthrow the government.
You're changing the question,
he's
though.
Ineligible.
You're changing the question. Because first we were talking about, well, What did the framers of this amendment, people at the time, how would they define insurrection? Now, what you're asking about
would they have defined it that way?
But that's two different things. It's what is an insurrection and then what is giving aid and comfort or what is participating in an insurrection? So I think by any reasonable standard, you can say, well, at least make a good case that what happened was at least an attempted insurrection. These people were insurrectionists. At least there were people involved in this. Now, yes,
let's take a look. Do it at a state level. The Tennessee Three or whoever they were, right? Who got up and interrupted and sort of brought the proceedings to a halt over I forget even what the issue was now, healthcare or abortion or guns, I think it might have been. Plainly, they interrupted public meetings. They were doing so on public grounds. You had people shouting from the gallery. The General Assembly had to adjourn. Would they be insurrectionists?
No, there's a difference of kind here. The difference of kind is that while they're both people who are being loud and disruptive, the people in the Capitol broke through barriers, right? Assaulted officers, broke windows. So there was an element of violence there.
So the difference in...
Let me finish. Okay. That's the element of violence. And the second critical element is that what was actually happening at the time. What was happening at the time were the processes involved with the peaceful transfer of power between one administration and the other, as opposed to a debate about some sort of an issue. So that is fundamental to democratic government. That is fundamental.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point. That it has to go to the fundamental functioning of the government, not a particular policy issue.
Absolutely. And so to me, I think you can make a very strong case that, yes, it was an insurrection. It was thankfully a failed insurrection. Now, I do not agree that Donald Trump was directly responsible for that, though I do agree that he gave aid and comfort by failing to do anything to, at least initially, to halt that because he was too entranced by what was going on, whether that's through incompetence or some sort of a glee about people talking about hanging his vice president. I don't know, but it doesn't really matter.
Right. In my point, again, I'm sort of just trying to be a Socratic jerk here.
Sure.
But but I think, you know, it narrows the question because you're absolutely right. The problem is if you're at some point able to invalidate a candidacy, you will see swarms of these all over the place. And that was kind of what I was trying to point out, that everyone will be an insurrectionist.
Oh, yeah. If you want an insurrection, this would be a way to do it. Definitely. Yep. Yeah. So that's why I think in the end, I hope the legal challenges fail, because I have a pretty good idea what the consequences would be for us as a country. And even though I end up agreeing more or less with the argument, I hope for non-legal reasons that it does not succeed. And I don't think it actually will.
Yeah, I don't think so either, but we'll see.
Moving on, you know, Jay, there's one thing I've kind of come to realize looking at a bunch of data. I would say it's as certain as, I don't know, Donald Trump using exclamation points or all caps in his post. So it's pretty certain, right? The instant, the very second people listening to the show think I'm going to say something about supporting the podcast, they stop listening. Just like, boom, it drops off a cliff. So if you're one of those people, and you probably are, just give me 1 minute before we go. You know, I listen to a bunch of podcasts, and I don't financially support most of them because, I mean, come on, who does that, right? I mean, and also I'm on a Kentucky State employee salary. You don't even want to know. But one thing that's absolutely free and only takes a minute, not even that probably, is leaving a rating, even a short review of the show on whatever podcast app you're listening on. It really does help us out, because the more of those we get, the more likely it is that people are going to find the show and check it out. And that's how we can keep on going. And another thing that's free and really helps us out is sharing our posts on X and Facebook. Almost nobody does that. And it's my fault, mea culpa, because until recently, what I posted for you guys to share has been awfully, awfully dull. I've been working on that, putting together posts with little audio clips that I think are interesting and engaging and maybe sometimes provocative. I have some ideas about from today, Jay, some stuff you said that I think will work really well, but I think it should be more postable, more shareable. So please, if you could do that, it would be a huge help. We don't have a huge marketing budget. Hell, we don't have any marketing budget. So if people hear about the podcast, it's going to be largely through word of mouth, which means social media or podcast search, which means sharing.
The only way we'll get the insurrection going.
There you go. You know, yeah, exactly. And of course, if you can't support us financially, that helps a ton. We literally could not do the show without our Patreon supporters. And if you become a Patreon supporter, you get ad-free versions of everything, the full-length midweek episode, not just that short in preview. access to our supporters Discord, where there are great conversations all the time and other stuff as well, like the opportunity to be part of our supporter participation episodes as we're recording them, Politics Guys swag, a bunch of stuff. Go to patreon.com/politicsguys, or you'll see that in the link in the show notes. Check it out. We also now have a yearly support option on Patreon. I think I mentioned at the top of the show. Gives you 10% discount at every level. That's good for current supporters too, if you want to move from monthly to yearly. But maybe that's too much of a commitment. You can also just do a one-time thing at Venmo or at Politics Guys or on PayPal. You'll find the support link for that in the show notes. And if you want to get that full midweek episode, but you're not in a position to support the show financially, there are a bunch of people who are right there with you and they've taken advantage of this. Just send me an email, mike@politicsguys.com. I will get you set up with the full access to the complete midweek show. Don't be shy. I'm happy to do it for you. And finally, if you want to reach us for any reason, maybe you think you were listening to our discussion of the debate or Donald Trump's eligibility, and you think Jay or I got something completely wrong, we want to know about it. We do corrections or amplifications, clarifications all the time. Let us know. mail@politicsguys.com. You can also do that on our X or Facebook accounts. Links are in the show notes, or if you're a Patreon supporter, on the supporter Discord group. And finally, as always, a very special thanks to our fantastic executive producers. You guys are the best. Bruce Johnson, Wilma Moreno, Andre Masker, Daniel Toe, Ryan Beasley, and Don Oglesby. We'll be back with a new episode for you next week. We hope you'll join us.